When discussing LP spaces up until now, we've always restricted attention to P less than infinity. But in fact, L infinity is an interesting and important space in its own right. So now we will talk about L infinity. And after we understand L infinity a little better, we will see that it fits in nicely with the LPs for P less than infinity, but it's defined in a slightly different way. So let's begin with a little review. Let F be a function from the space X into the reals. A real number A is called an upper bound for F if F of X is less than or equal to A for all X. A convenient way of saying this is that F inverse of the interval A infinity, which is the set of all X in X where F of X is bigger than A, is empty. Set capital U sub F to equal the set of all A in the real so that F inverse of the interval A infinity is empty, and define the sup of F to be the infimum of U sub f. This defines the supremum, or at least upper bound, of the function f. Now, by analogy, consider a measure space, capital Roman X, capital script X mu. Let f be a measurable function on X. A real number a is called an essential upper bound for f if the set f inverse a infinity has measure 0. In other words, a is an essential upper bound if f of x is less than or equal to a for almost all x in X. As we said in the last paragraph, let U, capital U, sub F, super essential equal the set of all A in the real so that mu of F inverse A infinity is 0. Be the set of all essential upper bounds, we define the essential supremum of F to be essential sup of F to be the infimum of capital Roman U, sub F, super essential. If capital U, sub F, super essential is non-empty, and essential sup of f to be plus infinity otherwise. Of course, the essential infimum of f is defined in a similar way. F is said to be essentially bounded if it has a finite essential supremum and a finite essential infimum. So, as always, it's best to understand a new idea like this with some examples. So here's the first example. We'll use Lebesgue measure as usual to find f of x to be 6 if x equals 3, minus 5 if x is minus 3, and 1 for all other values of x. The literal supremum of this function is 6, and the literal infimum of this function is minus 5, but these values are only assumed on a set that has measure 0. Off of that set, the function is constantly equal to 1. Thus, the essential infimum and essential supremum of f are both 1. Now, for another example, let g of x be x to the fifth if x is in the rationals, and arctan 2x if x is in the irrationals. This function is unbounded both above and below, because x to the fifth is unbounded. So its supremum is plus infinity, its infimum is minus infinity, but the unboundedness is based on values of the function taken on domain elements which are rational numbers, which is a set of measure 0. On the irrational numbers, which is a set of full measure, the function equals arctan of 2x, so it's bounded above by pi over 2 and bounded below by minus pi over 2, so the essential supremum is pi over 2, the essential infimum is minus pi over 2. Okay, definition. Let x, comma script x mu be a measure space. The space L infinity x mu, or just L infinity, is defined to be the collection of essentially bounded functions. The norm on L infinity is a double bar F double bar L infinity is the max of the essential sup of F and the essential inf of F. Theorem: the space L infinity is a Banach space. So that's similar to LP for P less than infinity. Those are Banach spaces also. Proof that L infinity is a linear space is routine. That is to say, it's very easy to check that the sum of two L infinity functions is L infinity, and the scalar product of an L infinity function with a scalar is L infinity. So we'll leave those details for you. The interesting part is to check that L infinity is complete. So let FJ be a Cauchy sequence in L infinity. Let E in capital Roman X be a set of measure 0 such that absolute fjx is less than or equal to double bar fj l infinity for x not in E, and j equal 1, 2, 3, and so on, and also so that absolute value fjx minus fkx is less than or equal to double bar fj minus fk l infinity for all x not in E, j and k equal 1, 2, 3, and so on. Note here that the set E is obtained by taking the countable union of sets of measure 0 coming from different values of J and K. The sequence Fj is uniformly convergent on x take away E, just by the way we've defined it. We let f of x be equal to the limit as j goes to infinity of fjx if x is not in E and 0 if x is in E. It follows that f is measurable, of course, and it's easy to check that the limit as j goes to infinity of double bar fj minus f l infinity goes to 0, so therefore l infinity is complete. And that completes the proof of that result. Now we're going to shift gears and talk about an entirely new topic called Lebesgue outer measure. So we're going to concentrate now on presenting the idea of Lebesgue measure from a different point of view. This is using the idea of outer measure. In fact, outer measures are quite intuitive, and you may find this approach to be appealing. This is the approach that many texts use. The approach that we present here works very well in Rn for all positive integer values of n, but in order to keep things simple, we will concentrate, as we usually do in this course, on just R1, the real numbers. So definition, let E be a subset of the reals. We define the Lebesgue outer measure M star of E to be the infimum of all sums j equals 1 to infinity length of ij, where the infimum is taken over all sequences ij of open intervals in R that cover E, in the sense that E is a subset of the union from j equals 1 to infinity of I sub j. Of course, the script L here denotes the ordinary notion of length of an interval. Remark, outer measure has these properties. Number one, since the intervals I sub j equals j minus 1, j plus 1 cover all of R, they certainly cover any subset E of R, so the infimum above is not over the empty set. Clearly, M star of the set E is always bigger than or equal to 0, and it's also entirely possible for M star of E to be plus infinity. That's comment one. Comment 2, the terms length I sub j are all non-negative, so the series summation j equals 1 to infinity length of I sub j is either absolutely convergent, in which case the value of the sum does not depend on the order of the summation, or it's divergent, in which case the sum takes the value plus infinity. So, some further remarks. A, it is most common to use open intervals in the definition of outer measure, but we could just as easily use closed intervals, and the resulting theory would be the same. Comment B, it's also possible to use half-open intervals, but there's no compelling reason to do so. Comment C, fix a number delta bigger than 0, we could define the outer measure using intervals that have length not exceeding delta, and the same theory would result. And in fact, this third comment will actually come up in a proof that we give later on. Theorem. The outer measure M star satisfies these properties. A, 0 less than or equal to M star E less than or equal to plus infinity for all subsets E of R. B, M star of the empty set is 0. C, if E is a subset of F, then M star of E is less than or equal to M star of F. D, if capital E sub J are countably many subsets of R, then M star of the union of the EJ is less than or equal to sum of the M star of the EJ. So that's countable subadditivity for the outer measure. Remark, notice that we did not in this theorem specify countable additivity for outer measure, and there's a reason for this. The simple reason is that outer measure is not countably additive when it is applied to all subsets of R. We must find a criterion that allows us to restrict attention to a particular collection of subsets of R, and that of course will be a sigma algebra of sets that we will call the measurable sets, and we'll develop these ideas below. Proof of the theorem. For property A, this is obvious from our earlier discussion. Property B, this property is also obvious if we take each ij to be the empty set. Property C, if ij is a sequence of intervals whose union contains f, then that union also contains e, and that gives the result immediately. And for D, which is the only really interesting assertion, it suffices to prove the result when M star of EK is finite for each K, otherwise the inequality is trivial. Let epsilon be bigger than 0, and for each K in the natural numbers, choose a sequence IJK, J equal 1 to infinity of intervals, such that EK is in the union from J equals 1 to infinity of IJK, and summation of the lengths of the ijk is less than or equal to the outer measure of ek plus epsilon over 2 to the k. which we can certainly do by the definition of the outer measure. Since the IJKs is a countable family of intervals that covers the set union k equal 1 to infinity ek, we see from the definition of the outer measure that the outer measure of the union of the ELs is less than or equal to the summation jk equal 1 to infinity of lengths of ijk, which equals summation k equal 1 to infinity summation j equals 1 to infinity length of ijk, which is less than or equal to summation k equal 1 to infinity m star of ek plus epsilon over 2 to the k, by what we wrote above, which equals the summation k equal 1 to infinity m star of e to the k plus epsilon. Since m star of e is bigger than or equal to 0 for any set e, then the change from a double set to an integrated set is certainly justified, so there's no problem there. And since epsilon bigger than 0 is arbitrary, the proof of property D is now complete, because we would then have that the outer measure of the union from L equal 1 to infinity of EL is less than or equal to the sum from k equal 1 to infinity of the outer measure of the EKs. Property D of the theorem is commonly referred to as countable subadditivity, and I've used that phrase with you before. One consequence of E is that if A and B are disjoint sets, then the measure of the outer measure of A union B is less than or equal to the outer measure of A plus the outer measure of B. From previous experience, we might expect to have equality in this last displayed equation. However, such a property does not hold in general. We can show that if there is a positive distance between A and B, then equality does hold. But without such an artificial hypothesis, we will find that we need to restrict attention to a special class of sets, which we will call the measurable sets, in order to get equality. So here's a proposition that makes this assertion concrete. Let A and B be disjoint subsets of R with a distance between A and B, which is the infimum of absolute A minus B for A and A and B positive. Then the outer measure of A union B is the outer measure of A plus the outer measure of B. Proof. We saw in the previous displayed equation that the result is true with less than or equal replacing equal. Thus, it suffices to prove that the reverse inequality holds when the outer measure of A union B is finite and delta, which is the distance between A and B, is positive. So let epsilon be bigger than zero. Let I sub j be a covering of A union B by open intervals such that the summation j equals 1 to infinity of length I j is less than or equal to the outer measure of A union B plus epsilon. As previously noted, we may assume that the intervals I j each have length less than delta. So that's why we made this earlier comment about using short intervals. So none of the I j's can contain both points of A and points of B, because the distance between capital A and capital B is, of course, delta. As a result, we can divide the intervals ij into three subclasses. The intervals capital J sub j that contain points of A, the intervals capital K sub j that contain points of B, and the intervals capital H sub j that contain neither points in A nor points in B. And those are the only three possibilities just by logic. So we have the outer measure of A is less than or equal to the summation of the length of J sub j, the outer measure of B is less than or equal to the summation of the length of K sub j, and from this it follows that the outer measure of A plus the outer measure of B is less than or equal to sum of summation over J of the length of capital J sub J plus summation over J of the length of capital K sub J plus summation over J of the length of capital H sub J, which is the summation over J of the length of I sub J, because I sub J is just the union of the J sub J's, K sub J's, and H sub J's. And this is less than or equal to the outer measure of A union B plus epsilon. And we conclude that the outer measure of A plus the outer measure of B is less than or equal to the outer measure of A union B plus epsilon. And since epsilon greater than zero was arbitrarily small, we conclude that the outer measure of A plus the outer measure of B is less than or equal to the outer measure of A union B. And that's the opposite inequality that we had to prove. Next, we show that at least for intervals, the outer measure M star gives no surprises. What do I mean by that? Proposition. If I is any bounded open interval, then the outer measure of I equals the length of I. And that's the way it should be, of course. Proof. Since the sequence I, empty set, and so on is a covering of I, it follows that the outer measure of I is less than or equal to the length of I plus the length of the empty set plus the length of empty set plus the length of empty set, which is the length of I plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, which is the length of I. And that establishes one inequality. For the opposite inequality, let epsilon be bigger than 0, and let I sub j equal 1 to m be a covering of I by open intervals, so that the summation j equal 1 to infinity length I sub j is less than or equal to the outer measure of I plus epsilon. Let capital J be closed, bounded in a closed bounded interval contained in I, and so that the length of I minus epsilon is length of the length of J, less than the length of J. The Heine-Borel theorem then tells us that there is an M in the natural numbers, so that capital J is a subset of the union from J equals 1 to M of I sub J. See the figure. This, of course, is just compactness. Of course, the intervals I sub J will in general have some overlap. Let P1, P2 through PK be the endpoints of the I sub J in natural order in which they occur on the real line. Consider any closed interval which has endpoints some sequential pair PJ, PJ plus 1, and which is a subset of one of the intervals IJ. Call those closed intervals K1, K2 through K sub P. Likewise, let J1, J2 through J sub Q be those closed intervals into which J is divided by the P sub J. Then we have that the length of J, which is the summation from K equals 1 to Q of length J sub K, which is less than or equal to the summation from L equals 1 to P of length K sub L, which is less than or equal to summation R equals 1 to M of length I sub R, which is length less than or equal to the outer measure of I plus epsilon. So we see that the length of I less than or equal to length of J plus epsilon, less than or equal to the outer measure of I plus 2 epsilon, and since epsilon bigger than 0 is arbitrarily small, we conclude that the length of I is less than or equal to the outer measure of I. And putting together the two inequalities that we've proved, we have that the length of I equals the outer measure of I, and that's our result. A similar result can be proved for closed intervals or half-open intervals, so we leave the details for you. It is an easily established fact, and we leave the details for the reader, that outer measure is a translation invariant. That means that if E and R is a subset, and A is a real number, and capital E sub A is the set of all E plus A for E and E, then M's the outer measure of E is the outer equals the outer measure of E sub A. So this just says that if you take a set and slide it around in the real line, its outer measure doesn't change. And that's the end of today's lecture. Thank you for listening.